ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
How does the war between Israel and Hamas end? What will it take?
What would bring peace, genuine peace, that lasts? Is anyone imagining new solutions?
To be viable, any peace plan must have the buy-in, not only of Israelis and Palestinians. The region as a whole will probably need to be on board.
So could the real Middle East leaders please stand up?
I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue.
This is Global Roaming. Well, g'day, Jerry. I'm super impressed with your M&M reference in the opening of the episode this week.
No. I don't know about the M&M reference.
Well, you know, will the real Middle East leaders please stand up? That's an M&M Slim Shady reference, isn't it?
I plead guilty. I didn't realise that. I was trying to be terribly precise and sort of point to the possibility of what I'm hoping we can achieve in this episode. So thank you, Hamish, for educating me.
We'll listen to some Slim Shady the way home today.
You know, I just might allude me too.
It's a big point in the calendar, though, isn't it? It's Easter for Christians, Ramadan for Muslims. It's just been Purim for Jews. And so I guess a period of reflection for many people. And I suppose we've wanted to come at these issues in a thoughtful way. And so the news also this week has prompted us somewhat.
Look, yes, we have wanted to do that. And we've said to listeners, you know, we've been thinking a lot about this. And the thought of trying to find some green shoots just I find incredibly inviting. And that's what we're trying to do here today. So rather than just go over exactly the same ground that we've all been hearing in copious news bulletins and headlines, what we're trying to do here today is to say, as various people are starting to say, hey, are there possibilities amidst all the disaster and the horrors and the tragedies? Are there possibilities for a new way of doing things? It is often the way in the Middle East. Amazingly, after terrible amounts of blood are shed, it can be a circuit breaker and things can move in directions they never have before. Now, are we at that point now? And that's what we're trying to wrestle with.
I think we do need to acknowledge that for many of you listening, though, it will be difficult at this point to be thinking too much about green shoots and positivity and optimism. For many of you, you might see the events of October 7 very difficult to move past yet.
On the spectrum.
It's not even 6 months since that happened. There are still Israeli hostages being held. For some of you, it will be difficult to look beyond the humanitarian crisis that's unfolding in Gaza. The figures at the moment stand at something like 32,000 in Gaza. That's according to the health ministry there, which is, of course, Hamas controlled. And there's some argument about the figures, but we know the civilian casualties are enormous. And we know that there are allegations, for example, of starvation being used as a weapon of war. There are serious fears about what happens next.
And they're still stuck in, you know, right in the south, around Rafah, about 1.5 million people in not their own homes.
So we acknowledge all of that. And for those of you that find this difficult, we're hoping to have a conversation today that at least looks forward somewhat, because this UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire is an important moment in the sequence of things. This is a significant development. Obviously, the fact that the United States abstained from that vote is fairly important, given that that effectively waved it through. And of course, whether or not Israel abides by that ceasefire remains to be seen. But it leads us really to the conversation we're having today, because the US role in the region has been enormous for many decades. There's questions about the degree to which the US is still able to manage and leverage its power in the Middle East. And certainly what's clear is that the relationship between the US administration and Benjamin Netanyahu's government has broken down somewhat.
It's evolving, I think.
Evolving is probably a diplomatic way of putting it. It's difficult. And so this raises a question about, if not the United States, if not the usual players, if not the usual figures, the Netanyahus, the Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority leader, if not the people that we've come to know in this picture, who comes next, and which countries might lead through this.
Yeah, and look, I think this is the point. We've got to learn new names, new personalities, new people who can stick their heads above the parapet, new people who are ready to say, okay, we've got it. Just like it was with Mandela and de Klerk, you know, they took their South Africa into a whole new era that nobody foresaw. Now, is that something like that on offer? I don't know the answer, but that's exactly what we're going to try to tease out with Dr. Sanam Vakil, who is our very welcome guest. She's director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, which is one of the world's leading think tanks. She's Iranian-born, educated in the West. She recently co-authored a very interesting piece in Foreign Affairs magazine titled "Only the Middle East Can Fix the Middle East." I think that sort of says it all, and that's what we're going to try to tease out with her. So I'm very pleased that she's with us, Hamish.
Here she is, Dr. Sanam Vakil. Sanam, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you for having me.
This vote from the Security Council on a ceasefire, whatever it ultimately ends up being, does it, in your view, present an opportunity to really start imagining what comes next?
One would hope so. I do think that this vote is very symbolic. The U.S. has not abstained from a resolution against Israel since the Obama administration. But there is a sense that this vote on its own isn't going to get the ball rolling towards a day after kind of thinking, really, because Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is seizing on tension with President Biden, perhaps to rehabilitate himself as prime minister and to prolong his premiership. And so I don't necessarily see this as a turning point.
In the immediate term, though, do you think this impacts whether or not there is a full-scale invasion of Rafah, whether Israel actually moves in there?
It could slow it down. I think that there are a strong chorus of voices, including from former President Donald Trump, actually, that is making the case that Israel's international reputation is seriously being damaged and that the Israeli leadership needs to take pause and weigh the broader consequences of such an invasion. And hopefully it will have impact. There are some deep divisions among the Israeli cabinet right now. The defense minister, Yoav Gallant, was recently in Washington, and he's been having very direct conversations with the Biden administration about managing the Rafah invasion or incursion to protect civilian life. I think what we are seeing is a slowing down of this process. And the key here is, can that process be slowed down enough so that a ceasefire, even if it's temporary, and a hostage release can be negotiated in order to bring down tensions and to start, again, the momentum of conversation about the day after?
And Sanam, what we're really intrigued by this week is to question whether we could be on the cusp of seeing a new Middle East. I mean, this gorgeous title of your article, "Only the Middle East Can Fix the Middle East." Can you see a time, dare we dream, when the region itself takes the lead on big internal shifts?
Well, this is really an effort at sort of shining a mirror on what we've seen in the region over the past few years. This has been a real striking shift away from direct military conflict and tension towards de-escalation and diplomacy across the Middle East with countries that have had adversarial relationships for quite a number of years, from Iran to Saudi, Turkey and the Gulf states. And of course, through this time, we've also seen the Abraham Accords between Israel and the UAE and Bahrain also signed. So, you know, we're in a new period of the Middle East. And our article was an effort at trying to push the Middle East to take a bit more responsibility. I certainly think that in the context of geopolitical tensions and what looks like a consistent constraints on the Biden administration to manage the Middle East all by itself, it's very clear that the U.S. is the only external actor that is trying to push diplomacy. But the reality is that the U.S. isn't as effective as it used to be. So yeah. Within this geopolitical and regional landscape, I think the Middle East has a responsibility, particularly Arab states, to work together for regional stability and hopefully for Palestinian sovereignty and statehood.
Well, who, in which countries, which leaders, who might lead us through this next phase?
Well, you know, this is a very optimistic scenario. But since the tragic events of October 7th and the war on Gaza, there have been five Middle Eastern countries that have been working together and maintaining unity and collaborating behind the scenes and also through multilateral diplomacy. And that's the UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan. And together, you know, they're perhaps referred to as the Big Five. They do have different, maybe strategic visions for leadership in Gaza and in the West Bank and how to curate a Palestinian state. But they are working for a ceasefire, humanitarian aid coming to Gaza, and thinking collectively about the day after scenarios. And also, if you keep track of Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State's travels to the region, he is always stopping in the capitals of all of those five countries, recognizing that they are the key interlocutors in terms of what's going to come next.
So we know the countries that might step up. What about the people, the figures? Because, you know, there's quite a lot of weight behind this argument. You've got to get rid of Netanyahu. You've got to get rid of Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader. Got to get rid of Hamas. Which people take their place?
That's a big question. And I can't say that I have answers. I think a lot of the problem is that the Israeli public is very much and rightly traumatized by the events of October 7th. And so the landscape in Israel is still very much stuck on October 8th. And it is beginning to slowly open up and awaken to the fact that Netanyahu has still not secured the release of the remaining hostages. So there is mounting pressure on the prime minister, but not yet such that his coalition is breaking apart or that clear opposition figures are emerging in Israel. There's a suggestion that should elections transpire, we could have a security-oriented government led by Naftali Bennett with Yair Lapid and the current defense minister, Gallant, as part of a next coalition. But we just don't know. And I think it all depends on when things break down. On the Palestinian side, I don't have the confidence to make a call on that, really, because nobody has taken an electoral poll in Palestine and across Palestine.
But who are the personalities? Like, because there are names thrown around and they're, you know, people like Mohammed Dalian, who apparently the UAE favours. But I mean, are you hearing names mentioned?
Not from Palestinians, to be honest. And I think the problem is that the Saudis might have their person and the Emiratis have their person and the Egyptians have someone else that they feel comfortable with. But we don't know who the Palestinians feel comfortable with. And that's the problem with this whole discussion. Nobody has engaged with Palestinians to see who and what composition of individuals should come up. Mahmoud Abbas has appointed a technocratic new prime minister named Mohammed Mostafa. And he isn't part of the political landscape. So for the time being, he's going to try to shepherd through the reform process. But from what I'm hearing on the ground from Palestinians from across society is they don't want to be pressured into a process right now. They need to go through their own sort of traumatic recovery and have the space to think about what comes next. People have dusted off the two-state solution from the box that they put it in 20 years ago. And sadly, I think the reality is going to be a bit more complex. And the longer this war drags on, the complexity of Palestinian statehood and security for Israel, you know, it is going to get harder to address.
How realistic is it, though, that whatever the immediate next step or steps are, that it is about Palestinians making that decision for themselves? Because given where things are, even if there is moves towards Palestinian statehood, isn't there going to be some kind of version of administration security that's provided or imposed from outside? And if that's the case, is there one of these versions, whether it's the Qatari version or the Egyptian or the Saudi version or the Emirati version that might be more realistic?
Well, I think you're quite right to point out that, you know, here I'm calling for Palestinian agency over this process, but certainly the Palestinians on their own aren't going to have the self-determination that they deserve, and that is going to cause some problems. I think that this is very much in the hands of the U.S. and the international community, but also, of course, Arab countries. The different versions are quite similar, but the reality is that Arab states, Gulf states, have to be very supportive of the day after process, reconstruction, and support Palestinians in the reform of the PLO and the institutions on the ground in Palestine. Without that support, I think that these day after scenarios, these so-called day after scenarios, will be very much frustrated.
Look, I want to check something with you too then, because quite a few people, you know, desperate to see some sort of green shoots, say that the big risk taker is MBS, the head of Saudi Arabia, a young prince determined to change things. I think you write craving regional stability because he wants to make money in Saudi Arabia and tap into Israeli exchange of technology and so on and so forth. Can you see him, knowing what you do of the region, really deciding to, as I said, stick his head above the parapet and say, right, I'm going to sort of govern this through and set up new structures that you're talking about? What weight do you attach to that sort of drive?
I think you're quite right. MBS certainly has ambitions, and those ambitions are very much tied to the diversification and revitalization of the Saudi economy through his plan known as Vision 2030. He's very much understood that for this diversification to get off the ground, it requires international foreign direct investment into the kingdom, and it also requires regional stability across the Middle East. So this is what's driving MBS. Now, over the past few months, the Saudi government has very much dangled the issue of normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel, but the Israeli leadership hasn't budged. They have been prioritizing the war in Gaza, and Saudi Arabia is saying, remember, the bigger plan here, the plan was to integrate Israel into the Middle East, to build economic integration and give Israel what it had long been searching for, connectivity with its neighbors rather than isolation and terror with its neighbors. So that was the big vision being offered. Right now, the Saudis are the only country in the Middle East that have something to offer Israel in exchange for a process that the Saudis call a pathway to Palestinian statehood. So the war needs to stop for those discussions to begin. So without a ceasefire, without clear commitments from the Israeli leadership to think about the day after and to stop the war, the ability to get to normalization and Israel's broader integration in the Middle East becomes harder. So these are very lofty ideas right now as the war has gone on for 6 months.
So to that point, though, there is a humanitarian catastrophe unfolding right now in Gaza. This is not the sort of tomorrow question. There are all sorts of accusations, among them starvation allegedly being used as a weapon of war. So for all of this talk of next steps and moving forward, possibility of statehood, who actually can or will take responsibility for stopping the humanitarian part of this going further, developing into something even more serious? Is it the US? Is it Israel showing restraint itself? Is it Arab states? Who will actually act?
I don't think it's one country on its own. That's what we've learned over the past 6 months, that there is no one external actor that has the capability to take responsibility for what's going on in Gaza. The US has been indispensable, but ineffective. Europe, the UK, the same. Everyone has indulged Israel's response in its approach to Gaza. And here we are 6 months later with a catastrophe that the UN writes is leading to a million people on the brink of starvation. This is, you know, an abomination, I think. And it's on Israel, the United States, the international community, but, you know, also Arab states. So I think that there is a collective burden for what's taking place and what has been allowed to take place that nobody is really talking about.
We know you have to get going, Sanam, but I just wonder whether this idea of the region stepping up, actually taking responsibility, solving some of these problems with its own agency. Is there anything there that gives you hope? Like when you assess it in the cold light of day, does it make you feel like there is something better possible?
I would like to say I'm hopeful. I'm rather more realistic. In absence of a clear and decisive U.S., European, international plan to support regional stability and Palestinian sovereignty in the Middle East, I think that Middle Eastern states have no choice but to bear more responsibility. What October 7th has taught them, and I think taught us more broadly, is containing crises like the Israeli-Palestinian one doesn't solve the problem. It just puts a temporary plaster on it. And without some kind of decisive resolution, it will continue to destabilize the region more broadly. So what gives me hope is the necessity here. Regional states have woken up and recognized that stability across the region, economic diversification, domestic priorities can't be delivered without fully solving some of the crises that have been ongoing for decades now.
Sanam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sanam.
Geraldine, not a huge amount of optimism there. I suppose the realities of resolving anything in the Middle East, as ever, difficult.
Yes. Ironically, Sanam has written quite a lot more hopefully in various outlets, but when you come to actually talking about it, you hear the region, I mean, I've heard it before, they suddenly remember all the setbacks and all the equivocation that exists and the limits, even though, you know, I take the pessimism has a cost, as I think somebody
sure.
wrote the other day. So
I mean, it is noteworthy, right, that for everything that's happened since October 7th last year, those steps towards normalisation, for example, between Saudi and Israel, may be damaged, but have not fallen away entirely.
No, not at all. So anything but.
I do think that's worth kind of keeping front of mind. But that said, she made some very fair points about the complexities with delivering on any of these sorts of changes. Even that kind of the big five, the you know, regional powers that she was talking about. The United Arab Emirates has a different view to what perhaps the Saudis have about who might be able to run some kind of newly reconstituted Palestinian authority. There's not a shared vision as to what a two-state solution might look like, of course. And on top of that, you know, there is an active conflict. For the Palestinian people, it would be very difficult, I imagine, to see beyond what is right in front of them today. And for the Israelis as well, total political stagnation around these issues.
They must be desperate for peace. This is what I find so tragic, that people who are such victims need people who have some levels of power to pull some of the levers, to have the guts to step up and articulate possibilities and, you know, say, well, this is my plan A, what's your plan C then, please? And hold people's feet to the fire.
Well, there are both Palestinians calling for that and Israelis
yes,
calling
for
that sort of leadership. And I know we didn't particularly venture down this path, but the role of the United States in all of this still matters. It still is significant.
Sure does.
The reality is that Joe Biden doesn't particularly look like, I don't think, in this picture, a strong US president that can wield American power effectively. Clearly, the relationship with Netanyahu has broken down somewhat. There's lots of reasons for that, that not entirely to do with Biden, but some of them are. And clearly, in that vacuum, other players need to play their role. And the question really we've been exploring, I'm not sure conclusively, is whether Arab states can and will do that.
Watch that space. There is a vacuum there. Oh, gee, I hope some of them step up. I really do.
And Jerry, we're going to be exploring some of that over the coming weeks. We've got some very exciting guests lined up,
indeed.
Some big questions to ask. That's all coming down the global roaming pipeline. If you are on a road trip or taking a rest over this long weekend, please do take a look at our back catalogue. There's some fantastic episodes there, we think, and we hope you'll agree. Do take a dive in. Now, Jerry, it's time for recommendations. Only one from you this week, please.
Yes, sir. Look, I'm actually, it's a slightly cute way of doing one. Because we were doing this program and because people might have a little bit more time over this sort of ritual season to read, I've actually gone to The Conversation, which is that marvellous online journal that people can go to. And it was something published in November last year, which I'd saved and found, 10 books to help you understand Israel and Palestine.
10 books?
10 books.
No,
as I said, it's a cute sidebar way of being. But they got 10 experts, a range of different people, and they recommended 10 books. Look, I think that's incredibly clever.
We're going to have a meeting with the producer, with Hugh. Human resources. We need the rules.
Am I disobeying?
Recommendation per person per week.
Yeah, but this is one collective recommendation, and I just think it will really help people make a choice. And you notice that I'm not preferring. I'm being clever here,
Geraldine.
See, I could be a diplomat in another life. You know,
you just
I could.
Recommended 10 books. My recommendation, since you're so free and easy with the license, is off topic this week. It was sent to me by a friend. It's an essay from the London Review of Books dating back to 2013. Now, it's actually not just a recommendation; it's a gift for you because you are so engaged and engulfed and consumed by this story about Kate Middleton.
Oh, yes.
It is an essay by Hilary Mantel.
Oh.
It's not a topic I'm particularly fascinated with. It's called Royal Bodies, so it predates all of this.
Mm.
But it references Kate and Diana, the Queen. It sort of goes well back into Tudor times and, of course, other matters that Hilary Mantel has written about. It is so beautiful. It's such a beautiful piece of writing. I'm just going to read a snippet. I'm ashamed now to say it, but I passed my eyes over her as a cannibal views his dinner, my gaze sharp enough to pick the meat off her bones. I felt that such was the force of my devouring curiosity that the party had dematerialized and the walls melted, and there were only two of us in the vast room. And such was the hard power of my stare that Her Majesty turned and looked back at me as if she'd been jabbed in the shoulder, and for a split second her face expressed not anger, but hurt bewilderment.
My goodness, that is quite some writing, I have to admit. Happy. That is amazing.
Happy Easter, Jerry. Let's do some feedback. We've had lots of it.
We have indeed. And Graham from Applecross in WA, very close to where I grew up, has something quite pertinent. Northern Ireland versus Israel-Palestine. 30 years ago, both these troubled regions were at a crossroads. They shared many symptoms of failure, like religious hatred and terrorism, freedom fighters and so on and so forth. So how has Northern Ireland made such progress? And what are the key initiatives and compromises, marvellous word, which have enabled Northern Ireland to progress towards a happier society? What could the Israelis and the Palestinians learn from these tentative success leaps? There must be lessons. Maybe someone like Mary Robinson or Tony Blair could be interviewed. Now, Graham, we are on this case and trying very hard. May I just say that?
Jerry rings yes. Tony Blair every week. We've also had another nice suggestion, which you liked.
I did, from Karen in Inverloch in Victoria. I think it would be uplifting in this scary world to look at the role of art, literature, classical music, or any one of the arts in creating real-time harmony or a progression to a greater understanding between cultures that are currently conflicted. Again, very close to our hearts, Karen.
Huge thanks to our producer, Taryn Priadko. As always, she told us she's perfect and she pretty much is. Thanks, Taryn. Have a great Easter. Please give us a star rating, a like, a follow on any platform you're listening to us. Of course, we're available on the ABC Listen app.
Yes, have a lovely time of rituals. I think rituals are very important. Have a lovely time. We'll rejoin you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.